So our guest today is an author and editor best known for his series of horror novels, including works like Toadie, Stitch, The Immaculate, The Secret of Anatomy, and more recently, That Which Stands Outside. He's also published several novellas, including The Dogs and the Ugly Men, as well as short stories like Homeward Bound and Sins Like Scarlet. But of course, he is also a prolific writer of Doctor Who novels, and he's so far written several books for the BBC Books Doctor Who ranges, including The Body Snatchers for the Eighth Doctor, Deep Blue for the Past Doctor Adventures range, and Forever Autumn and Ghosts of India as part of his new series adventures. But more recently, he has written the novelisation of Wild Blue Yonder. We're delighted to be talking to Mark Morris. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing all right. Hi, great. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. We're really, really excited to chat to you about your experience on working on the novelisation and also obviously your many Doctor Who books in general. I guess we'll get cracking. So the first thing that we were going to ask is, obviously, I've read that you were a fan of the show from quite a young age. So first of all, I was just wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about your relationship with Doctor Who and kind of what it's meant to you over the years and what your earliest memory is of the show.
Yeah, sure. I was born the same year that Doctor Who started. So obviously started November 63. I was born in June. And I've since discovered that Verity Lambert actually started her job. I was born on a Saturday, and I've discovered that Verity Lambert actually started her job on Doctor Who on the Monday after I was born. So literally 2 days old when she walked into the BBC for the first time.
Oh, how fantastic.
This new job as producer. So that's quite cool. I quite like that idea. But my very, very first memory, thinking back, is of The Abominable Snowmen, which was 1967 and is a story that is, you know, mostly missing now.
Mm. So
I would have been 4 years old at the time. There are certain scenes that I just remember so vividly. And I just have really vivid memories of a lot of Patrick Troughton's stories and finding them utterly terrifying as a kid.
Right.
but the one that really, really scared me was Spearhead from Space with the Autons. That's the one that kind of really leaps out, and I would have been about seven then. I loved the show from the beginning, and I always loved things with monsters in and spaceships and ghosts and anything. I just kind of gravitated towards the kind of the dark, scary stuff for some reason. Even though it terrified me, I always went back for more.
Yeah.
But I'd say what really cemented me as a fan, I think, was the fact that it was when I bought my first Target Doctor Who novelisation when I was 11. And I didn't know they even existed up until that point. And I was just in a little shop with my dad. I had a bit of pocket money, and I noticed that there was a Doctor Who book on the rack with this big green tentacled monster on the front and John Pertwee and the Brigadier. And I thought, I'm going to get that. So I got that, and I remember taking it home, reading the back of it, sitting in the car reading the back of it, and realizing with this kind of thrill of fear that it was the same story as the one that terrified me with the living mannequins.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, with the autumn thing. So that just kind of grabbed me, and that also was just as Tom Baker was starting as the Doctor. So I think that was literally something like the day that part three of Robot was on or something, so he'd literally just started as the Doctor. And so it was kind of those two things more than anything that just kind of turned me from, you know, someone who really loved the show as a kid to a bona fide, like, dyed in the wool lifelong fan.
Yeah, so you were very much a classic hiding behind the sofa, traumatised Doctor Who child of the time.
Oh, God, yeah.
that's so nice, though, that you've got
It's all the scary moments that stick in my head.
Yeah.
And I think, and that was the first thing that scared me as a kid. So I think that was kind of what drew me into loving just horror generally, just horror fiction and horror films and things.
Yeah, Doctor Who is a good, like, gateway drug for horror, is a good way of describing it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, things like the mad Cyberman in the sewer in The Invasion, yes. And you know, just kind of certain little images just stick in my head so much.
Fantastic.
So obviously you started reading the Target novels at that age, and since then you've gone on to write for Doctor Who novels. So could you talk a little bit how you started writing for The Range, and how you first developed the relationship with BBC Books?
Yeah, sure. Well, my first horror novel came out in 1989 when I was 26, and kind of quite made quite a big splash at the time. And so by the time I kind of started writing Doctor Who books, I was reasonably established as a horror novelist. Mm. I think I'd written maybe three or four books by then. And I had a friend who worked for Starburst magazine, actually, doing the review column, David Howe, who was a big Doctor Who fan.
Oh, interesting.
So Virgin did their New Adventures range, and then I kind of read those. And then of course the Paul McGann movie came out in 1996, and BBC Books kind of took back the franchise and decided to bring out their own range of novels. And they were they didn't just want to use all the Virgin writers, they wanted to kind of have some of their own writers as well, and to kind of freshen it up a bit. So David knew that I was a big Doctor Who fan. I mean, we talked about it at various conventions and when we'd met up and things. And I think they used him as some kind of sort of advisor. So he just called me one day and said, would I be interested in writing a Doctor Who novel, the BBC, starting a range with the Eighth Doctor? And of course I leapt at the chance, submitted an idea for the Doctor in Victorian London meeting the Zygons, and it went from there, really. So yeah, it was so I was in there quite early on in that range. I think my book was about the third one that came out, something like that.
Oh, amazing. That's really interesting as well, because we had Esme Jakimi Pearson on the show last month, obviously, who wrote the Church on Ruby Road novelization, and she was saying that it's quite kind of, you sort of have to be quite established, and it was like the BBC contacted her because she was kind of a new, fresh author in the field, and they were kind of presumably looking for that new talent. So that's kind of interesting getting that perspective, obviously, because she's a lot newer to the industry as well. It's interesting to hear kind of how it was when you were kind of starting out. But yeah, no, that's actually on that note, what was something that was really interesting to me when I was doing my research on you, I just wanted to ask about it. I was reading that apparently you started out in your writing career, you were part of the Enterprise Allowance Scheme, which was a scheme to pay people like £30 a week to be like self-employed and work on stuff. So that was really interesting to me. I wonder if you could sort of tell us a bit about that, because that was quite a novel concept.
Yeah, it was. I think it was one of like Margaret Thatcher's initiatives back in the day.
Oh, right.
And it was basically, I mean, at the time, I remember you used to get £32 on the dole. If you were on the dole, you got £32. The Enterprise Allowance Scheme gave you £40 a week, so it was an extra £8. And I'd got to the stage where, because I'd graduated, but I had no idea what I wanted to do for a living still. And I just started writing for my own pleasure. I'd always loved writing. I just started writing and sending stuff off, and gradually started kind of selling little stories and doing the thing. And I thought, you know, I got to the stage where I thought, I really want to try and make it as a writer. But
right.
But so when the Enterprise Allowance Scheme came up, I thought, right, well, I'll apply for that and really give it a go. And I'd spent the time, I kind of put it off for a while, because what I wanted to do was write a novel first, so that I'd have that to try and sell while I was on the scheme, because the scheme only lasted for a year, and then that was it, the money was cut off. So I wrote a novel called Toadie, which did end up being my first novel, and then went on when I finished it, I went on the scheme, and fortunately, within about 6 weeks of going on the scheme, managed to sell Toadie.
And so
the money just from Toadie just started to generate just as my money from the scheme finished. So I was kind of able to keep going.
Yeah.
But it kind of turned out, I mean, I was looking at that again. I was in right at the beginning when they were kind of taking on, you know, loads of different people doing lots of different professions and things. But I hear that later on, because my wife was on it as well, and she's an artist.
Okay.
So she started on there. And then I heard later on that kind of art-based thing, you know, people who wanted to do art-based professions were being kind of phased out, because most of them obviously never make it.
Mm.
So things like writers, actors, artists, all that kind of thing, were just kind of use it, you know, having that money for a year and then not going any further. So
right.
It started to be far more for kind of, you know, I don't know, people doing more, how can I put it, more conventional things, I think. You
yeah.
know.
More profitable yeah. things.
Profitable, yeah, I suppose, yeah. But things that are more, that were more likely to, yeah. for them to be able to keep going. To
yeah. Interesting, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I've heard before about that scheme, that it was, you know, set up to encourage small businesses, and it sort of, it wasn't intended as an art scheme, but it was used by a lot yeah. of people in the arts as a loophole before they realised they didn't want to fund the arts. But that's
yeah,
that's,
exactly.
that's
yeah.
great that you managed to start your career, springboard it off of that, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, beat the system.
Yeah. So could you maybe talk a little bit about your writing process? How do you come up with ideas? Is there a lot of planning and research, or do you just sort of dive straight into writing?
It depends largely on the project, obviously, but for me, ideas are the hardest thing to come up with. I have friends who are writers who say, oh, I've got far more ideas than I'll ever be able to write. Whereas for me, the actual coming up with the original idea, I find so difficult, because you know, and I think about it for ages, and you know, things percolate in my head for months and months before I actually put anything down on paper. Because the thing is, you can come up with a lot of ideas, but then you always think, oh, that's been done before. And with Doctor Who, of course, there's so much stuff out there that anything you come up with, you always think, oh no, that's a bit like such and such, or that's a bit like this. You know, it's so difficult to come up with something completely new and original and stuff in Doctor Who. So I find Doctor Who ideas particularly difficult. But I mean, right. usually it gets to a sense where I'm in utter desperation. I think I'm never going to have another idea in my life, and then something just kind of clicks, and it usually works. So I've been doing that for like 35 years now, so hopefully it'll keep going.
Interesting. So, and how would you say that your writing and kind of the process also differs kind of from genre to genre and depending on the project? So for example, have you kind of noticed differences in the way that you would approach things if it's your own, you know, if it's an original idea versus you're writing a Doctor Who book, or it's an original Doctor Who story that you've come up with versus, you know, a novelization like Wild Blue Yonder, or an audio story as opposed to a novel? Like, is there kind of differences in the way you go about things?
Yeah, very much so. And a lot of it is, to be honest, is dictated by deadlines, because I've done a lot of time work. So, you know, I've done Doctor Who, I've done things like Predator and Hellboy and various other things as well. And usually you don't get, you know, very long deadlines with those. So with even like an original Doctor Who novel, I think it was kind of a 3-month deadline. So it's
right.
very much a case of launching into it quite quickly. Whereas with my own work, obviously, I don't usually have deadlines. I just write them and then sell them when they're finished. So I kind of tend to take my time a bit more with those.
Yeah.
Do a lot more research, a lot more kind of write, you know, sort of reading around a subject and gathering information. And suppose quite a bit more editing, where it's with Doctor Who, it's just, or with anything like that, it's just very, usually much, much tighter. It's quite easy with novelizations and things, because you get everything given to you. You get the script, you know, you get the story, you get the script, you get all the dialogue and all
right,
that kind of
right.
stuff. So that's usually a very quick process. And then it's just a case of converting it to prose, really, and trying to make it as you know, as fast moving and as exciting as it is on screen.
Yeah, I suppose it's still, obviously, even if you've got all those materials, though, I suppose it's obviously probably still quite a challenge at times to kind of know how that script and, you know, something that's intended for the screen will translate when you're trying to convert it to prose, particularly with Wild Blue Yonder. You're obviously trying to get across that sense of foreboding, and it's very much in the horror genre. So how did you kind of find that? Was that kind of a challenge, or?
I really loved it, to be honest. I mean, the thing with Russell's scripts is that they're so clear. He has a real clarity in his scripts, and he writes in such a way that you kind of immediately get it. You know, so the kind of the dialogue and the beats and the rhythm and everything of it just kind of gives you that kind of sense of. I mean, the whole script, when you read it, even without seeing it on screen, kind of just kind of drips with that eeriness that it has.
It has
this kind of sense of eeriness, and I love that. I mean, I kind of got right on board with that, and I love writing stuff like that anyway. And I suppose the difference is that you can go more internally when you're writing the novelization. So Wild Blue Yonder, for instance, was largely written from Donna's point of view, so you kind of get inside Donna's head a lot more. So you sort of hear her thoughts as well as what she says to the doctor and what she's thinking. But I was told with that script, because it's such a tight story and because it's kind of couched as a mystery, so, you know, you don't find out what's happening until it actually happens. You don't get any kind of sense of anything outside what the two characters experience. So you're experiencing it along with them. And so I was told not to embellish the script at all, not to add things. Like, I know James with the giggle got to really play with it, whereas I was told, right, keep it tight, stick to the script. So they wanted nothing about, say, you know, the original inhabitants of the spaceship or anything like that. They didn't want me to write about how they disappeared, where they went to, what happened to the captain, and where that particular alien race came from, all those kind of things, which you might normally have kind of thought, well, that would add a bit of, you know, a bit of extra stuff for the reading audience, but no, they didn't want any of that. They wanted it all to be a mystery.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Because I think in a lot of these Target books, a lot of the joy of them is how they sort of expand on the world a little bit, how they tell you things you don't get in the episode, but also... Yeah, I see the point. It's a mystery. You can't spoil the twists at all. You got to stick with it.
Yeah, I think it would undermine the story if you had that particular story. If you had too much information, it would just undermine the actual creepiness of the story.
It's interesting as well what you were saying about it's kind of written like very much from Donna's perspective, and that was reading the book, that was definitely something that I really enjoyed about it, because I feel like obviously in the actual episode, watching the episode, it's more kind of following both of the characters, and it's not necessarily trying to kind of get in either specifically the Doctor or specifically Donna's head, because it's more about trying to get in our heads and kind of, you know, mess us up a bit as a viewer, and kind of, whereas I quite liked with the novelization being able to get more of a sense of like what was going through Donna's head with all of the things that were happening, and it kind of added a real, I thought it added a real kind of humanity to Donna. And I mean, I know she's obviously a very lovable, likable character anyway, and we all know and love her anyway, but I really felt that it kind of added, I really felt it kind of got to the bottom of you know, what she's going through in that moment and her fears, and I thought that was a really nice way of approaching it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean that's obviously how, you know, to do it, to kind of humanise it so that we can all identify with it. And obviously, in those circumstances, Donna will be feeling absolute kind of abandonment and isolation, and, you know, oh my God, I'm so far from home, and all that kind of thing. And also, you know, what the hell is going on?
Definitely.
So yeah, and I love writing for Donna. I've written for Donna before in Ghosts of India, and I just find her an absolute joy to write for. She's just such a great character.
She is fabulous. We do love Donna.
Yeah, you've written for Donna before, and of course the Tenth Doctor as well in Ghosts of India and Forever Autumn. Like, was there any? Did it feel like you were slipping back into characters that you knew quite well, or?
A little bit with Donna particularly. They're obviously older, so you have to be aware that they're older and they've gone through more stuff. And obviously, this isn't the 10th Doctor; it's the 14th Doctor. But he is pretty much kind of the same character. You're not going to bring David Tennant back and then have him play a completely different character. It was like putting on a nice old coat, and just kind of slipping back into that. But obviously, this time I had all the dialogue, so it wasn't a case of me kind of coming up with the dialogue so much.
Yeah.
So it's an easier process when you're actually kind of given everything.
Yeah.
I did change little tiny bits of dialogue here and there just because they just sound slightly odd when you read them, but they sound fine when you watch them. But they sound slightly odd when you read them. So there were little bits that I changed here and there.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you probably wouldn't spot them unless you were kind of watching the episode and looking at the book at the same time.
Mm. Yeah. And just going back to the horror genre, so obviously you've got all this experience in horror. We were just wondering how you translate that when writing Doctor Who novels, because obviously Wild Blue Yonder, there's a lot of horror in it, and the novelization kind of brings that out a lot. Like, for example, I think there's a comment when Donna copies arms stretch, and the book mentions that you'd expect there to be sounds of tendons tearing and bones snapping, which is quite grim for Doctor Who. So how do you approach like adding that in, but knowing where to draw the line, how to determine what's appropriate to put in?
Yeah, I mean, with Doctor Who, it's kind of an instinctive thing, I think. I mean, with when I wrote the Body Snatchers, they did want to push it a little bit more. Because obviously it came from like the Virgin New Adventures, which were far more adult, so they wanted to kind of keep that going a little bit but just rein it in a bit more. So I think when I wrote the Body Snatchers, I had the Scarrison going on a big rampage through London, and that's quite a gory scene, probably gorier than you would write now. Whereas I don't know, it's kind of because Doctor Who is kind of entrenched in my DNA, I kind of know the boundaries instinctively. And I'm really talking about my own stuff here, because obviously with Wild Blue Yonder, I was given the script, so you couldn't go beyond those boundaries anyway. But it actually, in the script, it does mention. I think Russell does mention when the arms stretch. He actually says something like, we hear no sounds of sinew snapping and bones breaking or anything. It's something like that. So I kind of picked up on that and used that, I think, in the book as well. But yeah, a lot of it is just kind of instinct with Doctor Who. You sort of know, you're aware who the audience is, you know how far you can push it, you can make it scary but not really gruesome. It's like with a lot of things, not to put swearing in, and you know and all that kind of stuff.
I guess some of it's kind of self-explanatory. But so would you say that kind of being a horror writer anyway, and sort of having that background in horror, do you think that's kind of helped you a lot with kind of your relationship with Doctor Who and understanding the show and how it translates to books and writing the books? Because obviously there is quite a lot of overlap between Doctor Who and the horror genre. So do you think that kind of plays to your advantage, and kind of like, do you think that maybe kind of gives you an edge when you're writing or coming up with Doctor Who ideas?
I'm not sure if it gives me an edge, because I think that Doctor Who can do so many different things. It can be space opera, and it can be comedy, and it can be historical drama and all those kinds of things. But I think I know definitely Russell chose me to write this book because of my horror background, because he knew that this was the creepy story, so he said, oh, I want Mark to write this one. I think the thing is, Doctor Who for me is like my kind of genesis of experiencing horror. It's like the first time I ever experienced anything scary that I watched on TV. And so, it's for me, it's like it's like the very nub for me of like why I love horror. And it's always the scary stuff. It's always the scary stories that stick in my mind, mm. or the scary moments that stick in my mind. And it's funny when you kind of talk to, I've done Doctor Who talks and things in schools with kids, and it's the same now, you know. It's
even, right.
And it's things that you wouldn't expect, you know, as an adult, when you watch it as an adult, there are certain things that you kind of almost skim over. There are some certain stories that don't seem that significant. But then when you talk to kids about them, say, oh, what, you know, what do you really remember? What are the scary moments? And like things like in Night Terrors, the little dolls, you know, the dolls with the chuckling dolls with
yeah.
their faces painted on, stuff like that, which is,
yes.
in some ways, it's kind of almost one of those, I wouldn't say throwaway stories, but it's one that people, adults, perhaps wouldn't significantly remember, because it's just a kind of a, I like to think of a kind of like a bread and butter story where it doesn't have any other, you know, far-reaching,
yeah.
like returning monsters or anything to do with the mythos or anything like that. So but with kids, it's kind of certain little things like that that kind of really stick in their minds.
And
it's still doing the job that it did years ago, and then it's entrenching just these little images into children's minds.
Oh, definitely. Because, I mean, yeah. I remember as a child, like, one of the first... Because my parents kind of tried to get me to watch Doctor Who with them. I was 7 when it came. I think I was 6 or 7 when the reboot came back, which feels bizarre now at age 25, that it's like I was only 6 when it started again in 2005. But I vividly remember my parents being like, oh, you know, this was a show that we used to like. Do you want to try and watch it with us? And I remember watching a lot of the first series with Christopher Eccleston with them, and I have a vivid memory of the of being absolutely terrified by the gas mask dummies. That episode, the empty child, absolutely petrified me. And it's those kind of images that stick with you, and the kind of, you know, are you my mummy, like all of that. God, I remember being completely terrified by that. So I think it's definitely those things that kind of almost like shape a generation with that's kind of one of the most important elements, I think, of a show like Doctor Who, is the way it kind of captures children's imagination.
And so you would have experienced the Autons. If you were 7, you would have experienced the Autons at the same age that I experienced them with Spearhead from Space.
Yeah, no, I would have done. That's it's funny to think that, yeah.
The new
era of Autons. That's really fascinating as well. Like that, I didn't realise that you'd got to do like talks in schools and things, and kind of chat to children. How did that sort of come about? What kind of happened with that?
That was a joy. Well, it was actually I couched it as a workshop, as a writing workshop for children. So it was
to
go into. It was like the top end of primary school, so it was year 5 and 6 when they were getting like 10, 11 years old. So they were just at that perfect age for, you know, loving Doctor Who. And it was mainly when I'd written Forever Autumn and then Ghosts of India. So it was around that period when Doctor Who was, you know, massive among kids again. And I just started. I just came up with this idea of doing a workshop about how to create a Doctor Who monster.
Oh, cool!
And so I used to go into schools, talk about it, you know, talk about writing for Doctor Who, and then we'd just go through like little processes of, you know, how do you create a monster? How do you make it effective? How do you make it scary? All those kinds of things.
Mm.
And at the time, obviously, there was a lot of Doctor Who monsters that were based on things like animals and stuff. So I'd say, quite often how they make it scary is by basing it on like something that we're familiar with, like an animal. And also a lot of their weapons, or the way they attack people, were through things that, like, everyday things, like, for instance, the Sontarans used sat navs, and, you know,
Yeah,
used diet pills, and, you know, things that we're familiar with. So I used to go through those things and say, so what is the, you know, what is it that we're all really familiar with, that's around us all the time, that could maybe sort of turn against us? Of course, the Autons use plastic, you know, so just all those things. And yeah, and it was just really fun. I mean, the kids were so enthusiastic.
Yeah.
You know, they were so excited, which is, it's great at that age because they become far more cynical when they get older.
Yes.
Yeah. And I do workshops now for kind of 17-year-olds, not Doctor Who ones, but other ones. And you kind of walk in and they're looking at you like, you know, who are you? Kind of thing. You know, yeah. I'm not going to give you anything kind of stuff. So you have to kind of win them over a lot more.
Yeah,
10-year-olds are just so excited to see you straight away. You know, it's great.
Yeah, no, I bet that would be really, really lovely getting to work with that age group.
I used to do some with Robert Sherman as well.
Oh wow! Okay.
So me and Rob, occasionally Rob would come over and we would go and do these things together. So that was good fun.
Oh, that's really nice. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I bet that was a really, really nice experience.
Yeah.
Actually. I remember meeting Robert Shearman at a National Student TV Awards thing. Like he'd judged a competition that I'd entered at university, and he gave some really lovely writing advice. He was really just a really generous and lovely person with it. So yeah, I can imagine a workshop done by the two of you would be really fun.
It was good fun.
Can we just talk about, so obviously you mentioned your first Doctor Who novels published in the 90s. You could get away with it with a bit more gore and stuff in them.
Yeah.
And you've been writing for a few different like eras of the show since, and now for you know, the Disney relaunch of it. Is there any other ways that the experience of writing for a Doctor Who has changed over those 20 whatever it is years?
That's a good question. Well, because I've done lots of different types of Doctor Who writing, I suppose, you know, each kind of different type, would be my own novel or a novelization or a big finish audio drama, they're all kind of different disciplines. You know, you have to approach it in a different way. So in the sense, I mean, I think Doctor Who has remained very, very close to its kind of initial I don't know how you describe it, but its initial spirit, I suppose, in that it's still, you know, it's still creating just wonderful stories about this character and his friends who, you know, go and save the universe in a little blue box and all that kind of stuff. I mean, obviously, it's moved on as time has moved on. It's kind of developed, but I think you can see that even in the original series. You know, you can watch that from the very first episode right up to the end of Sylvester McCoy, and you almost see like the development, not only of TV but kind of social development as well, and just through those stories. So I think you can almost see like the cultural development of the country through Doctor Who, and obviously there was that big gap in the middle of 16 years or whatever. So in that sense, it hasn't massively changed, I wouldn't say. I think it's still just a case of, you know, just coming up with exciting, fun, original, scary ideas. And hopefully that will always be the case.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting as well, that you kind of, the show sort of, you feel like the show kind of changes with the times, but is still kind of essentially the same. Because I guess that's kind of what sci-fi is about, in a sense, that it's not really about the future. It's kind of a reflection of the time that we live in, isn't it, in many ways. So that's interesting to see how the kind of the episodes might reflect sort of the social and political kind of norms of the time.
I mean, the thing is as well, they also try to keep it with the technological aspects of the time, which weirdly dates it, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, I know sometimes it gets criticised for that, you know, like the computer graphics in the TARDIS in Peter Davison's time, for instance, or whatever.
Yeah.
But at the time, they were like, you know, they were like state-of-the-art stuff, and now they just look quaint and funny and old-fashioned and weird. But I think, you know, you just have to go with that, really.
Yeah.
You just have to go with it.
And when the writing's good, you can look over that often.
Like, absolutely, yeah.
There's a lot of you know, really good old TV, Doctor Who and other stuff that maybe people should get over their worries about the effects in, because you know, when writing's good, if the storytelling's good, it's worth your time.
I love Star Trek, like the original series of Star Trek is one of my favorite series ever. And I wrote like a little kind of, I don't know, poem sort of piece on called like On Why I Love Star Trek. And one of the lines that I actually put in it is Star Trek is feeling extraordinarily protective of terrible 60s special effects. And like, it's kind of that sense of like, you know, you've kind of got to admire it for what it was, I guess, in a way.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is with Doctor Who, I just admire its ambition. You know, always. They always try to do amazing things on such tiny budgets and in such tiny studios. And I think you've just got to admire it for that, and just you've just got to embrace it and let your imagination flow. I was talking to somebody yesterday, actually, another writer, about... He said he'd started watching I, Claudius again, and he'd remembered it from when he was a kid as being this amazing drama. And he said what really struck him was that it's like a stage play on TV. He said, because, you know, it kind of looks quite cheap and clunky, but he said you so quickly get caught up in the acting and the characters that none of that matters. None of the background matters. And I think that's just, you know, the spirit that you should embrace it in, to be honest.
Yeah. And I'd always rather watch something that has low budget but big ambition than you know, the opposite. Like, there are a few massive budget films that come out and, you know, they spent $200 million on it, and you think, like, the script's just, like, dull. And
yeah, they just
why would you not get that right? The first easiest, well, not easiest, but the cheapest bit to get right.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree with you. Yes, I think there is this sort of opinion that, oh, you know, massive set pieces and massive effects can carry it through, but no, you always need that human element. You always need that charm and that humor and all those kind of things that we relate to as people.
Yeah. On that topic then, what are your kind of thoughts on you know, the kind of increased budget of Doctor Who now that Disney's got involved, and kind of the sort of new level of special effects in the new series? Do you think that's kind of going to be a positive thing, or do you think that in some ways it's actually kind of almost making the show a little bit too grand in a way?
No, I think it's absolutely no problem, because as long as you marry the great special effects and all those things with great writing, then you're going to get the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
You know, and as long as we've got, I mean, I don't know how long he's going to stay, but as long as we've got Russell at the helm, I don't think you can kind of go wrong. I mean, Doctor Who can look fantastic, but if the writing's not great, as we all know, then it's just dead in the water, you know. So there are, fortunately, it's not happened too often, but there have been occasional stories, I think, along the way where you just thought, oh, that was terrible, it didn't work. And it might have looked fantastic, it might have had great location filming, great effects and what have you. So I think, you know, the key to it is always just maintaining that kind of intrinsic element of charm and the stuff that we all love about the show.
Yeah.
Just this kind of eccentric central character, whoever it may be. And you know, that sense of huge affection that he or she has with their companions, and then them just going off on adventures together, and it just being witty and funny and you know, scary and all those kinds of things. And if you can keep that going with the writing, then I think you know, the show's in great shape.
Definitely. And speaking of the writing, are there any particular kind of Doctor Who monsters or characters that you particularly love to write for?
I've done a lot of them. So I adored the Zygons. So my first pitch with the Body Snatchers was to bring back the Zygons, and they only ever appeared once then. So for a lot of people, they were almost like a kind of slightly forgotten monster. So I was really chuffed to write for the Zygons. I've written for the Daleks for Big Finish, and that was great. I wrote for the Cybermen in a short story that I did. And I wrote for the Mara as well in something.
Oh, cool.
Tales of Trenzalore. I wrote a Mara story.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the thing with Doctor Who is I'm always wary of it kind of disappearing into its own history. And
yeah.
I think, you know, if I was really, really pushed, I think if you said to me which is your favourite era, it would probably have to be like the sort of second Tom Baker season onwards for about three or four seasons, because they kind of just went off around the universe and there were very, very few returning monsters. Obviously, he had Dalek Cybermen and Sontarans in his first season. But then after that, it was all kind of new experiences and new creatures and new places. And I really like that. I think, you know, I almost got a little bit antsy when they started bringing back the Daleks kind of every New Year's Day or once a season. And I would really just love them to, because I think they lose their impact if you use them too much.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, you know, when in Rob's original Dalek, the Dalek was such a scary, kind of powerful creature. And the more you use it, the more they kind of become less than that.
Hmm.
And I really would hope that they kind of just start using the old monsters a bit more sparingly. I know some fans will just moan and say, oh, I don't think that the old monsters. But I really just hope they kind of spread them out a bit more so that they just make more of an impact when they do come back.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to give, like, some new faces a turn as well, because you never know what is going to become the next classic villain, I suppose. Mm. You could always have, like, a newly created evil that becomes as iconic as the Daleks, you know?
It does seem that this new era is going that way a bit, like, you know, the 60th anniversary specials. Okay, so Beep the Meep and the Toymaker are sort of throwbacks in a way, but they're not the throwbacks that anyone expected to see. And now we've got all these new, like, supernatural villains coming in, like the goblins, and it seems like we're getting some new takes on threats for the Doctor to face.
Yeah, and I think it's lovely when maybe if there's been an alien or a monster from years and years ago that hardly anyone remembers, when they bring those back, those are exciting. I think, I mean, if you sort of really said to me, who would, you know, what would you like to see come back? I'd quite like to see the Axons. I'd really like to see the Axons come back, because I think there's a lot of scope for the Axons and Axos. I think that would be a great one. And also stuff that you can kind of, that's not one dimensional, like in Mask of Mandragora, they talked about, you know, Mandragora would come back round again at a certain time, and you could do so many different things with that. It is exciting when kind of worn off things come back. And especially something that's not been around for years. I remember when I did my first I think it was Forever Autumn, and we were taken to Cardiff to see the first three episodes so that we could get to grips with who Martha Jones was, because she hadn't, you know, when we wrote our book, she hadn't actually appeared on screen. And there was a group of us sitting around in one of the rooms at the studios watching these three episodes, and one of the episodes was Gridlock, and I remember the moment when the Macra appeared, everyone was so excited, because the Macra hadn't been in Doctor Who for, you know, donkey's years. It only ever appeared once, and everyone was just so excited by that kind of link to the past. Whereas if it had been the Cybermen, it wouldn't have been quite so exciting.
I think with the Macra as well, like, if you didn't know, like, if you're a new fan of that era, you didn't know about the Macra Terror, it worked just as well. Like, it absolutely worked on both levels, which was a good way of doing it. Not so it didn't seem too much of a continuity overload.
Yeah, true.
Could you talk a little bit about, you've got another new book recently published, That Which Stands Outside, inspired by Nordic folklore. Which, could you just tell us about that and the inspirations behind it?
Yeah, it's not out yet. It's out in July.
Oh, sorry.
That's fine. And the inspirations behind it. It sort of started out because ages ago, I was asked to possibly write an audio drama based on the unproduced third Wicker Man script.
Oh, wow.
Which then fell through. I mean, I read the script and tried to do a kind of adaptation of it, and it didn't quite work. And And it was very. I mean, the script was kind of a bit all over the place because I think Robin Hardy wrote it when he was very kind of getting towards the end of his life, and it wasn't completely finished and polished and stuff.
Right.
And so we had to change the story a lot. I mean, a massive amount. And it never happened. But I was kind of left with some of my notes, and I thought, you know, a lot of these notes that I've kind of made here and things, and things that I've elements that I've brought in, could be used for something else because they weren't nothing to do with the initial script. And so a lot of them were to do with things like Nordic folklore, which the script touches on, but in a completely different way. And so I thought, well, if I, you know, kind of develop some of these ideas, I can create something of my own and maybe write a novel. So I did that, and then I just, you know, kind of ran with those ideas, created new characters, all that kind of thing, and it sort of slowly came together. And so it's kind of set on a fictional kind of Nordic island, and it's about an isolated community. And about a woman who goes back to when her mother dies. She comes from the island, but she lives in London, and she has an English boyfriend. Her mother dies, and they go back to the island, and then they get caught up in all sorts of, you know, strange events, and there's all sorts of rumours about her and all sorts of things. So a lot of it is from his point of view. So it's very much a kind of fish out of water story.
Interesting.
So he doesn't know the local language, and you know, a lot of conversations take place that he's not really privy to because he doesn't know what they're talking about. And so it's this kind of story about paranoia and about being, you know, I don't really know what's going on here kind of thing.
Sounds really fascinating.
So some of the ideas kind of stemmed from the initial spark stemmed from this third Wicker Man script, but then it was completely changed everything about it, and came up with my own stuff. Yeah,
sounds like that's going to be a really, really interesting read. I'll definitely have to give that a go when it comes out. It sounds like it's going to be a really, really spooky read.
Well, I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm sure it sounds like a really, really interesting concept. What would your sort of top advice be then, would you say, for someone who's kind of wanting to go into writing, or they're kind of interested in the horror genre and kind of trying out their own ideas?
I mean horror's quite going through a slight boom period. I mean, there's lots of really good stuff out there, and there's quite a few publishers who are now, you know, publishing horror again very kind of vigorously and enthusiastically. As I always say, if you want to be a writer, then just write. I mean, write all the time, write every day. Even if, you know, a lot of people I come across always say, I I'd really love to write something, but I just never find the time, or I can only do it now and again. I would just say write every single day. And even if you've got a full-time job, you could write a page in the evening.
Yeah.
You know, if you write a page a day, then at the end of the year you've got 365 pages, which is a novel, basically.
Yeah.
My advice would be just write all the time as much as you possibly can. I've had friends who've had full-time jobs, and they literally take notebooks on the tube and just jot stuff on the tube.
Yeah.
Also, read a lot. Read not only within the genre but outside the genre, and just get a feel for how other writers do it and how other writers write, really. How they create characters, how they create moods and atmospheres and things.
Yeah.
And the third thing I would say is develop a thick skin. Don't be too downhearted by rejections, because you will get rejections.
Yeah.
Every writer gets rejections. Even if you're quite well established, sometimes, even today, I get rejected for, you know, I'll send out a short story and I'll get a rejection. But if you get that, then just send it somewhere else.
Absolutely.
You know, just keep going, basically, yeah.
Very, very solid advice. And yeah, in terms of writing something every day as well is advice that I definitely need to pay attention to, trying to work on my own bits and bobs. That's definitely something I should do. So very, very solid advice. Yeah, so that is almost all we've got time for. Just to kind of wrap things up, I suppose, going back to Doctor Who, we can't let you go without getting your thoughts on the 60th specials and on on Shooty Gatwa and Millie Gibson and kind of the new era so far.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely loved them. You know, I just think they've got such energy. I mean, the three specials are all very, very different. They've got a really different atmosphere to this. I'm talking about the three, like, David Tennant ones. Just a lovely, wonderful atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But just a kind of sense of just sheer verve and energy to them that I just think carries through. And then Shooty, yeah. I think, as the new Doctor, he's just an absolute joy, I think, so far. He's just an absolute delight. I think he's like, you know, a breath of fresh air. I think his Doctor's going to be very different to previous Doctors. Maybe he comes across as a bit more human in a way. You know, not as aloof, not as alien. But whether that will carry through or not, we'll see. But I think he's just a great... I remember, you know, when I first heard that he was given the role, I was just so happy because I'd seen him in Sex Education as Eric, I think, his character in Sex Education, and he absolutely, you know, shines out of the screen. He was like my favourite character, my wife's favourite character. So when we heard that he was going to be the new Doctor, we were so happy. I think he'll be an absolute hit. And so far, Millie Gibson, I thought in her first story was great. I know there's kind of rumours now that she's kind of left after one season, which is I think would be a real shame if that's true, but so far she's been brilliant, I think. And and I love her whole family setup as well. I think that's just all just lovely and warm and you know, and gives a real kind of sense of depth to that character as well.
Yeah we're both really, really enjoying the new episode so far, and I'm loving Shooty and excited to see more of Millie. Is there anything in particular in the upcoming series that you're like excited to see, like based on the trailers and what we've been teased so far, or have you got any theories as to what's going to happen?
I've no theories whatsoever. I mean, just all of it, to be honest. It looks fantastic. I mean, I like the fact that this Doctor actually doesn't have a costume as well. You know, I like the fact that he dresses differently every story. And he dresses appropriately for every story, and I know that sounds like a really obvious thing, but it's a kind of quite a departure for Doctor Who. So I really kind of just like that fact that every story looks as though it's going to be very, very distinctive, and really kind of stand out on its own. And everything we've seen so far, I mean, you know, the 60s thing meeting the Beatles and the Regency stuff, and you know, the few clips of monsters we've seen, it just looks brilliant. I can't wait for it.
Does look like it's going to be a very, very exciting series. So we're looking forward to seeing what goes on with that. Oh, well, thank you ever so much for coming on and talking to us. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, but it's been absolutely lovely to chat to you, and really, really interesting to get some insider knowledge on what it's like working on Doctor Who novels. It's been a really, really fascinating insight into a different side of the Hooniverse.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed myself. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Lovely to talk to you.
Really lovely to talk to you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
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 Oh, really great to chat to him. I really thought that was really fascinating about the kind of picking out those moments that children kind of are looking at from behind the sofa as well. That was a really interesting insight about picking out those things that sort of, you know, a new generation will kind of latch onto. That was really interesting, I thought. It is now time for Who Knew? Yes, indeed. We have a few bits and bobs of Doctor Who news and discussion to share with you today. It's been relatively quiet on the news front, but we do have a few interesting little tidbits to share. So I guess we will start off with the news that many of the Doctor Who scripts are being made available to sample.
Yeah, so the BBC have this wonderful resource called BBC Writers' Room, where they put up a lot of scripts from their TV shows, just for anyone like anyone interested as a fan to read, or anyone interested like as who wants to get into writing themselves can see how scripts are put together. And there's been some Doctor Who ones on there before. But now there's been a big new batch added, including, well, over 115, including all the new specials, Torchwood Class, Sarah Jane Adventures, Tales from the TARDIS. And, you know, I think, well, it carries on from sort of what we were saying with Mark. He was saying, like, as advice for writers, yeah, you should read. And I've written, like, films myself, and one of the main things that I'd really advise to anyone wanting to get into screenwriting is just to read other film and TV scripts. It's such a good way of understanding how the format works. So I think it's lovely that they put all these on
definitely. So it sounds like it's going to be a really good resource for budding writers, as you say. And I heard that also there's a an old Doctor Who script of Russell T Davies that he wrote when sort of before he was even working on the show. I think there's a few kind of hidden gems like that. So
yes,
it sounds like it's going to be a really interesting little archive for people to delve into. Yeah.
And the 15th Doctor audition script as well, which is like it's just eight pages, and it's the scene that they audition the actors to. And it's like it's one that was never intended to be filmed. It's just the Doctor and a companion trapped in a room together. But it makes it an interesting, fun little read as as an extra Russell T Davies Doctor Who sketch.
I didn't even know about that. I'll definitely have to check that out, because that sounds really interesting. Yeah. Do check that out if you're a budding writer, or even if not, give it a whirl if you're a big Whovian. We've also got the news of a couple of new directors have been announced for season 15. Amanda Brocci and Michaela McPherson are going to be directing at least one episode each in season 15, apparently. So they've Brocci directed Gentleman Jack and McPherson directed some episodes of Waterloo Road, so they're really great directors, so that should be interesting to see what they do with their time on Doctor Who when they arrive in season 15. So we'll be looking out for that. That's the other bit of news.
Yeah, and as well as that, there's a little bit of casting news. There's an actor called Genesis Lanier, who you might know from Death in Paradise or a show called You and Me, who's been announced to be in the upcoming series, the series this year. Unfortunately, we don't actually know what role she's playing, but it's nice to have a little tease of a bit more news that's going on.
Indeed. And the final kind of interesting thing that's been going around,
the controversy of
the slight controversy that's been going around social media. We don't know how much this is really going to affect things in the grand scheme of things, or what may come to pass from this, but it's certainly an interesting development. So apparently the BBC has announced that it is going to be experimenting with AI for promoting certain shows, and it's starting with Doctor Who. So apparently they're planning to use some kind of normal human written marketing copy to create Doctor Who notifications, email subject lines, and promotional rail on BBC Search. So they're going to be using a normal human marketer to come up with that, apparently, and then they're going to be using AI to suggest alternative copy, so that they can kind of come up with different versions, and it will kind of hopefully they're ostensibly doing this to sort of free up creative minds so that they can spend more time creating the original
free
copy.
Free up but, money yeah. that they were spending on creative minds. I think people have been very, very, very cynical about AI, and often for good reason. I don't think AI is good at writing stuff at the moment. You know, I've had a look at some stuff that's been generated by ChatGPT, and it's largely nonsense, isn't it? And it often, like, it doesn't understand facts, which, you know, you hear a lot of stories of students generating essays with AI, and they're just being absolute nonsense made up citations in it.
Yeah.
I think in this case, like, it's probably not a serious problem, because, like, it sounds like they're just using it as a bit of a thesaurus, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I think people often, a lot of the people who are really into AI, like, big it up as if, you know, it's this amazing new technology that's going to replace humans, when, you know, really, it needs to be managed by humans. And ChatGPT is basically not much more than a pimped up thesaurus.
Well, yeah, I mean, because I work in marketing, and at my previous company, they were kind of very big on AI and sort of testing out what it could be used for. And yeah, I think what you're saying is true. So from my experience using it, because I was kind of asked to use it to kind of help me with some of my copy when I was doing copywriting, and it's certainly not, as far as I can tell, an effective tool for kind of creating a piece of copy and just rolling with it. You know, you have to kind of have that human touch and kind of correcting it afterwards and adding your own flair to it afterwards. But to me, it kind of sounds like the BBC have probably got the right idea in terms of what they're using it for, because it doesn't sound like they're using it to actually, you know, create original pieces of writing and marketing, which, because if they tried to do that, then it probably wouldn't be that effective. But if they're kind of getting a human being to create, you know, a sample piece of marketing, and then they're kind of using the AI to create different versions of that and sort of add to that idea, then that's kind of the right sort of thing to be using AI for, whether or not it's ethical in terms of kind of, obviously it is maybe going to be putting somebody out of a job, you know, that's another issue, that's a whole nother debate. But
I had a job where I was writing some content for a website, and for some reason, I don't work for this company anymore, but they told me, "Oh, well, you should put it in this AI thing, and it will suggest alternate phrasings for all your sentences."
Mm.
I did, and in every case, the alternate phrasings were bad.
Yeah,
And you know, that seems to be the case a lot of the time. So, you know, it might well be the case here that the Doctor Who marketing team will be saying, "Yeah, we looked at the AI thing, we got it to suggest some phrases, then we used the one that we came up with." I also did find it funny how in this announcement the guy said, and it comes with the extra bonus that Doctor Who lends itself thematically to AI, which sounds like the kind of thing that someone who's never watched Doctor Who would say, because I think there must be at least five different stories in it about computers turning evil.
Yes. Well, I kind of get where he's coming from, in the sense that, like, you know, in terms of creating images, like if you're using, you know, I don't know, Midjourney or something like that to create kind of images, then, you know, that kind of space, swirling stars, time vortex, that is the kind of thing that Midjourney and other kind of AI photo tools do quite well. But I'm not entirely sure if that's what they're going to be using it for anyway, so I guess it remains to be seen whether the technology will be of much help to them. But we'll see how that goes, I suppose. The other, they have also said that there is the potential, like, there is the potential to use AI potentially in the future for restoration purposes as well, which is where it might be slightly more effective, kind of updating, you know, restoring older episodes and, you know, colorizing and things like that. That might be where AI comes in more useful. The technology isn't there at the moment, but they're kind of hoping that might be something that it could be put to use to in the future, which I think would be a more effective way to use AI than coming up with marketing copy personally. But we'll see how it goes. It'll be interesting to see what the AI comes out with, if they use it anyway, so we will see. But yeah, on that note, that brings us to the end of another episode of the Blue Box podcast. Once again, thank you very, very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's episode and all of Mark's insights there. It was really, really interesting to talk to him. We'll definitely have to look at getting him back on the show in the future if he writes another Doctor Who novelization. It was really, really interesting to talk to him. As always, do get in touch over social media if you want to share your thoughts, particularly once the series comes back in May. Of course, we'll also be going back to analysing episodes, and it'll be great to get your insights on what you thought of various episodes. So do stay in touch over social media or email us. And thanks again for listening, and we will be back hopefully in about a month with another special guest. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you everyone. Have a great month.